Let me give a word of introduction first about the last 2 days and how I see the next three. The advantage of a book study, where we all have the book, is that we can move from that. We can assume the basic understanding that we all have of what Brown is saying and then expand that. And I realized that the last 2 days, in order to give people a chance to really get going on it and to make sure it was clear, we did what I don't think is necessary, and that's make sure we all understood the book. In other words, we summarized and clarified and underlined, and I hope we can move beyond that. What that says is if you don't do the reading, then you miss a lot. But it's more fair to the people who have done the reading to assume that as a kind of basis when we come and to expand upon that. Then you've somehow magnified the area of understanding that you have of the material. Lots of material in today's two chapters. I mean, you can, in almost every one of his 4 points in the first chapter, you can have all kinds of bibliography, further reading, bring you up to date, that kind of stuff. So I think we can cover a lot of material today. Secondly, that's the first thing. So I'm going to assume the reading, and we're going to not assume that we have done violence to anybody by not covering the exact pages here. We're starting with those, and we're going on from there. Secondly, I want to pause once in a while to make sure that we are not going over something which for you was either an insight or a question. And I realize that we have a fairly short time together, so I'm going to do that at the beginning today instead of assuming we might have time at the end. In the last 2 days, is there either something that you'd like to share, the way Becky had a chance to yesterday at Vespers? I thought that was neat, that the rest of the community shared a little bit of some of the things that Tom and Becky had from the study. I thought that was a good use of that time yesterday as a community. Or a question, and you want to flag it right now, or you want to spend some time and clarify it before we go on to something else. Is that true for anybody here? Insight, aha moment, new understanding, or big question mark, puzzlement?
A reinforcement of what I already knew, but that's valuable.
Okay.
How difficult it is to really deal with the magnitude of the issue. Just again, trying to encapsulate it for last night. You know, was a real challenge, and felt I wanted to kind of spell out that continuum. But feeling like that, you know, it's kind of like the way we struggle with bread or potato cake. What are some ways that we can get a handle on it, mm-hmm. so we don't lose it. It's for me, and I think for most of us, such an easy thing to kind of completely lose sight of, and also getting a fair number of semi-blank stares. Mm-hmm. it's not one that is easy to draw people in. Statistics are one way for me, and there's a statistic in one of our chapters today, I forget which one, that talks about, if I can pull it out.
1,500 people die every day.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, that, see, I can't relate to that. I mean, I can, but I can't. The one that hit me was on the same page 31. In 1970, the increase over the previous year in gross national product in the U.S. was greater than the entire. And I thought, oh, that's startling, but the last statement is gross, that we had more for luxuries than Africans had for everything. One of those kind of little symbols of the problem that kind of grabbed me, and I get a visceral reaction to that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the increase in gross national product, that's not even luxury, that's even more than luxury. That's the creme de la creme, or the cream of the, that's the top of the top.
Cream on top of the cream.
Right. At that point, I thought how much it cost me to drive to Minnesota. Holding buildings.
Your income room.
Yeah.
Those are all statistics, really.
population like 10 times our population.
The thing that's really been kind of frustrating me is that I realize that one's ignorance can, and the way in which we live our lifestyle can elicit a violent hostile response. Just
do that again. But
it seems that just our ignorance in the way we live our lifestyle can elicit this kind of violence. We can just be complacent and think we're doing,
think we're not violent, but we don't have
Okay, all right. I didn't know how to say it the first day. Now you've said it, and I don't think we have to try to find a way. I said that those experiences in the 60s for some of us where we saw that even though we did not consider ourselves racist, we were in institutions, we were part of systems that were racist, and it took some black brother or sister to kind of take the time to point that out, and things began to I saw things differently. I think that's what Brown's trying to do on the violence one. It isn't that individual person is violent in the overt way.
Right.
There are people who are apathetic to the world's structures of violence who have never, quote, harmed anybody. They're meek, good-willed people. That's the kind of thing that Brown's trying to get through in much of this book. Okay.
I want to flag a thing related to that, but not necessarily talk about it now. Why is it? It seems extraordinary that this Medellin conference in South America was
68. Mm-hmm.
Was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that we need better ways for the average person to be in touch with what's going on in the relatively conservative institutions such as the church, gathered it hierarchically. Most Catholics, I suspect, haven't even heard of that conference. I hadn't even heard of it. I hadn't heard of the conference by name. And somehow there's just this big gap between what's really going on in the world and what the man on the street does.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that you might sense, and I agree with you, and I think part of it is we in the United States have not had a keen consciousness of the rest of the world and what's going on. I think that's part of it. And we really I don't think it's necessarily arrogance. There's just a kind of isolation, not meaning foreign policy and that kind of thing, isolation in our mentality of especially the third and fourth world nations. Secondly, the Theology of the Americas conference in Detroit that Time wrote up, are you aware of that?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, then there really is a kind of lie. The thing that happened in 68, even though you didn't hear of that conference, it was significant because 900 priests, it was a real turning around. He's absolutely about face for the Roman Catholic Church in Latin American countries that had almost entirely lined up with a minority of the rich and the powerful. This was an about faith. The thing that's called liberation theology is known and is a kind of, that's more important that we're reading Guterres and Alves and Bonino and than this conference. But I'm not sure that your point is not still true. I'm not sure most of us either are hearing much liberation theology or realize a large gathering in Detroit on the theology of the...
You pick up an article in Time magazine or something, and it's
Personally
tight, but that's about it. It just seems like an insightful thing. And I decided that part of the reason is that it's a press problem, that when thinking of the two kinds of violence, one kind of violence is newsworthy, the other kind of violence isn't.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
If violence is a permanent thing, then how can you pick out a certain point in time and make news out of it? It's very hard to do. How do you pick out a statistic? Do you say in the paper every day, well, 15,000 people died today, and then the next day, hey, it's news, 15,000 more people died today. It's not news.
Yeah.
I interrupted. Oh, no, I think I said what I was going to say. That's right, you were going to say something. Other things, that insights, questions? Yeah.
I just questioned myself, how can I change these structures, or how can I be a part of it, or how can I live without outside of them? structures that are causing covert violence. That
mm-hmm.
was real frustrating to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also sort of a new insight to me.
Did I know that we hope to have some of that on Friday? What does this mean? What would a church be in the midst of this? And I don't like 4 days with the greater and greater expectation that it will all be solved Friday. It won't. But we ought to set at least a day aside, which we've done. But in today's two chapters, do you have any clues for yourself as to what it would mean to be faithful when you find yourself, by birth and God's providence, both white and part of this affluent nation? I mean, it's really kind of a dead-end street to whip yourself and wish you were Latin American and hungry today. That's really not very... Okay. Do you have any clues from today so that we can kind of begin to anticipate the kinds of things that people might bring in Friday? Is that unfair, Sonia? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Ask everyone.
All right, yeah.
Think about it first.
All right.
I gave a speech last week that after reading this, I kind of wish I could retract. I still struggle. Because we had a horrible day with Fritz, and we all went out of here just crawling in the mud, and he was effective. And so the next day I made a strong speech about once at school when I told people that they shouldn't be out there working for Gene McCarthy. They should be in the library studying medieval standing poetry. And their job was to prepare themselves for 1990. And I was really unpopular, but I kept going around school saying, you got to do your drawing lessons and all of that kind of stuff. And then my speech also included, I had peace about spending a year here in 1971, which in a sense was a horrible time and it was running away. But I didn't really feel guilty about it, and I think it helped me a lot for the future. I'm in a silly business, in a society that's wealthy enough to tolerate silly people who sit around and draw pictures and scribble colors. And I used to worry, feel bad about that, but I believe in it. I'm not quite sure what the point of it is, but I believe it. I work in a wealthy school that costs a lot of money to go to, and reading this chapter makes that kind of difficult. I know that the school is concerned about the third world, and there are a lot of faculty working on it, but I don't think they communicate it very well to the school, to the community. Have you studied? You study third world in the religion department?
I study minority people. Of course.
But I guess that has to do with Friday. However,
majority.
I don't have any conclusion for all that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it's a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
I have to do what I'm doing, and I have to have. I have to believe in what I'm doing, but I also have to keep this pain alive and communicate it.
Deb and I talked about that afterwards, and we didn't feel what you felt, but Debbie says, it doesn't bother me that you would feel, in a sense, I don't use the word contented, that's too strong, but contented in that situation. But I just hope he's really thankful for that gift. it's hard to live in that tension, I think. I faced it in physics and haven't resolved it, because physics, for me, was not solving the problems of the world. It was maybe creating more, but the kind of physics I wanted to do was basically an artistic endeavor. It was a luxury. It was fun, that was creative, that was uplifting for humanity, I think, in the same way that art is, that was self-expressive, much the same way art is or poetry. But I was rather suddenly burdened by the luxury of that, that I could do that as long as there was going to be a world 10 years from now. And I wondered if I could do that if I was afraid there might not be one. Or I could do that as long as I didn't hear the groans of agony and despair. But when I started hearing them, it was very hard to concentrate on E equals MC squared.
Mm-hmm.
As beautiful as it is.
One of the clues for me in here was Dom Elder Camara, who really said, the point is not for you to come to Latin America. It's to really live out a faithfulness in your land. I mean, and it seems to me, in some ways, that's a harder call. You really will be counterculture if you try to have the vision of this structural violence and our role in it and live in Northfield. That's really a tough, whether you're painting or not, you really are part of a vision that is a difficult vision, but biblically speaking, that's sometimes the role. Again, we'll do this Friday. I'm just going to do this much so that you begin to try to pick up. And Brown is a good teacher. He will go back, he already did in this chapter, show why it was important to understand the kinds of violence. I mean, he has a reference point that he's almost saying, now this is why we spent time defining terms. And he'll move. Now, when you solve war, you remember that you don't solve the issues of violence if you solve war. In fact, keep quoting Pope Paul VI. You want peace? Work for justice. That's an important distinction. Even your definition of peace is an important distinction. And Brown will be a good teacher and move through that. But anyway, in the story of the liberation of the Israelites from Egypt, if you go back and read that, and try to make that current, we're Egyptians. As far as the world is concerned today, if you just have to divide it into oppressors and oppressed, we like to think that we're the Israelites when we read that, because God's people and we're the new Israel and all that. But just economically speaking, or if you want a view of history, the liberation movements in the world today, the reason we don't get them much in our press is part of what they're saying is liberation from us. And when we sing the Magnificat, throw the mighty from their seats, that's hard to sing in first world nations with members of the congregation, the corporate executives of multinational corporations. I'm just, the good news of the Bible would be almost without the necessity of a sermon, just reading the passage in many places of the world comes as good news to migrant workers. It's easier to read some passage of the New Testament to migrant workers than it is to the orchardists. But in Wenatchee, the orchardists are the Lutherans, not the migrant workers with those funny little old trucks that are always breaking down and kids all over the back. I'm saying it's sometimes hard to be the one who's trying to find the truth of this and to find the gospel in this, in the midst of the U.S. But in that freeing of God's people, the Israelites, from Egypt, even though you can say there wasn't much of a role for the Egyptians, God was working his liberation among his people, and they're going to get out of there. No matter what the Egyptians do or don't do, they're going to get out of there. But there's an if you go back and read that, there's an interesting phrase every once in a while. Some of the courtesans of Pharaoh were friends of Moses and kept speaking truth to power. That's, by the way, the name of a Quaker pamphlet. That's a pretty good understanding of the role of the church. Sometimes our role will be to stand up and to say the king has no clothes when everybody else is admiring the new gown. if you don't know that poem, I have to go back. I was assuming I didn't have to do you know that story?
Yes.
Parable? Okay. Sometimes the role of the church is to speak truth at the place of power. That's sometimes been the call. And that's not a real, it's not a real glorious one. You're suspect by the ones who are oppressed because you're part of the power structure, and you're suspect trying to live in the midst of the power structure from your neighbors because you sound like a traitor. So I'm not sure that the final conclusion as to the role is going to be easy. It might even be the way of the cross. But I think that's what Brown is trying to help with some of this background. Okay. Anything else in the way of that? All of those are ways to get into this chapter, so if you just want to continue that.
I want to tie a couple things together.
Okay.
Fritz last week, in talking about evil, I think defined it for him as insensitivity. Brown, at the end of chapter 3, concludes by talking about what a hard truth the stuff is that he's been dealing with. And in the final sentence, perhaps in our era, apathy is the unforgivable sin.
Mm-hmm.
Apathy, insensitivity, and the other connection or thing I want to pull in is to say the thing that I really appreciated about what John did that day. This is, you know, and I hadn't known John before, went to St. Oak, but never had a class with him. He's a deeply sensitive man, and I remember saying after he shared what he did that day, that was really gospel that day for me, because I was just wallowing in guilt and getting almost mad at Fritz for all this heavy stuff, you know, almost in tears 3 days in a row. And that was, you know, a deeply sensitive thing that you did that day, John. And I really appreciated that. And so if evil is insensitivity, if apathy is the unforgivable sin, that ain't where you at, me. You know, I just, you know, because you're here with us. And you aren't just off doing your art, and I just wanted to pull those couple things together.
I remember I told the story at Tecumseh Woods, that time when you said the shalom,
yeah,
in the shalom stuff. Daniel Berrigan came to give a talk, and it was mostly political leftists and people who were ready for violent overthrow and what have you, who came to hear him. This was one of their heroes from that institution called the church, and they had not many heroes in it, so Dan was there. And somebody said, now that you've been in prison, I'm sure you're working for the abolition of prisons. And he said, no. And they said, don't you think we ought to abolish all prisons? And he said, no, I think probably there ought to be some. And they said, well, you mean that we live in a society that is so bad that we need prisons to take care of some of the problems? And he said, yeah. And they said, well, what does one do if the society is such that we really have to conclude that maybe we need some prisons? And he got a funny grin and said, oh, something foolish. And they never understood him at all. I mean, they really turned him off. He really said, study medieval poetry, paint a picture. He gave a monk's answer. He gave a clown's role in the midst of a world that's so topsy-turvy that the only thing sane to do is something foolish. Now that's poetry, I understand that. But sometimes I think the role in the oppressor nation is to be, St. Francis said, we're tumblers for Christ. And he meant jugglers. He meant court jesters. He meant being the one person who still laughs at the stuffiness. Any time that the church poetically or with a film wants to give a Christ figure, often it is the clown. It's the one who is something foolish in the midst of taking yourself so deadly seriously. If you think of the anti-war protests, Berrigan was consistent with some of those things. The reason to rip up the curtains and pour blood in the White House is not because it's small children who revert to vandalism. They desecrated a building which we had made more than a building. We had made it a temple. and they did a foolish act, meaning trying to poke fun. At that time, we had a president who wanted the guards at the White House to go back and have uniforms with little hats that were back from a time when there was a king. I mean, he got laughed at. The whole country laughed enough that Nixon did. If you ever saw those, they were absurd. He was bringing court regalia into the White House. That's what the protest movements were trying to do. Sometimes that's a role, but it's not often understood. Okay.
It just seems to me that, first of all, we need to educate our church on these matters, and then the church will have a more effective role, like in Latin America.
Yes. Okay.
In fighting with the lack of education and ignorance.
Go ahead.
But it just has to be so skillfully done, because this kind of stuff is waving the red flag. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if the way to do it is to get people angry.
Mm-hmm.
No.
And there's some point where you have to get everybody mad.
Do you think this book would make most Lutherans angry? Is it?
No,
angry?
If you could really get them to read it.
I see.
But if they had read it, and you're sort of talking generally about it. I think of my neighbors, I live in the country, and they're farmers, and they really work hard, and they believe in that.
Yes.
I think it would make them angry.
Do you think this book would?
I think it makes an awful lot for granted that I can live with. Mm-hmm. But he's never proven the case that we are the oppressors.
Yes.
He's cited a lot of authorities indicating it, a lot of conservative authorities that have impressed me.
Mm-hmm. Like Robert McNamara.
Right.
I mean, he does try to do that, right?
But it still doesn't come through. If you basically have the point of view that, what do you mean? American capital goes over there and employs those people.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, we draw back profits. You have to make a profit. But look at all the money we poured into these countries.
Mm-hmm.
Look at our gifts to these countries in the way of foreign aid, and you know, you go on. We raise all the food for the country. Your mobile ad shows it. You know, sure, we use more resources, but look at all we're doing for the world.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people live with that image still.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the other aspect of that is sickening to hear as often as you do is, you know, when these people decide to quit accepting handouts and get out of business and work for themselves,
right,
then they won't be starving to death.
Mm-hmm.
What we should really do is stop all our foreign aid,
mm-hmm,
not offer any help anymore.
It's in the campaigns right now, at least in Minnesota, to got to get rid of that expensive Fraser and Wendell Anderson and that Humphrey gang and quit giving away all this money and
mm-hmm
all that.
Mm-hmm.
It's well known that the Catholic bishops in Latin America are all communists anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. I mean, that's really a feeling, I think.
We showed this summer the American Friends Service, NARMEC, National Action Research on the Military Industrial Complex. They have a sharing global resources. And all of the quotes are from either government documents or well-known news releases. And they show the Allende overthrow and the part we played in it. They show of all the countries in the world who do foreign aid, we are 14th out of 18 in percent of the gross national product that we give away. They gave the copper company that has 20% of its resources and 80% of its profits coming from Latin America, just time after time. Well, first of all, the thing was 45 minutes, and at Holden, a session usually doesn't run more than an hour, so there was not enough time to really filter it through. Some people were angry. Some people walked out. We had, as a summer theme, the book Lighten Our Darkness by Douglas John Hall, which really says that the theological task confronting the world today, not unlike this book, the theological task confronting us today is to contemplate the failure of our dream, and our dream is North America, Canada, the United States. And the premise of the book is not that we have failed in the dream and that if somebody else picks it up, like a Latin American country, they might make it. No, the point is the dream is wrong. Basically, mastery, continuing growth in national product, living with domination over the environment instead of with harmony with the environment. The dream is a failure, biblically speaking. And again, we had some good discussions on that. I think it was, I don't think people got upset, but I think we're going counter to even much religious stuff in the U.S. today that ties in Jesus and the American dream and really advertises financial success if you believe in Jesus. Those are the quote, successful churches. But anyway, we have tried in a way that I think did not just try to anger people. First of all, tried to be biblical, tried to give people their own tools theologically, because it isn't what somebody at Holden tells you, it's your own ability to separate for yourself and to know what really rings true, what has the authentic gospel to it, and what's not gospel. That's a real, if Holden gives you that ability, then it's successful. If Holden is a place you have to come back to find out, is that good or not? I mean, we've really bombed, and that's hard to do when people are here very briefly. Becky talked about the other day that one of the disappointing things is when the church acts as though there are not some basic biblical understandings on which we can say we've got a value that speaks to that, as though it's all a matter of individual things. When you're talking today's topic, like economic justice, I just want you to know that you're in a thoroughly biblical set of material. You say sometimes statistics helps. One out of every 16 verses in the whole New Testament has to do with economic justice issues. One out of 10 in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. One out of 7 in the Gospel of Luke, and 1 out of 5 in the Epistle of James. That's where it's the strongest. I just gave that lecture in Asilomar, California, so the statistics are in my head. 1 out of 16 verses in the entire New Testament has to do with economic justice, rich, poor, taking care of the needy, material things, and God's problem. 1 out of 16 in the whole New Testament has to do with some aspect of economic justice or what we're talking about today. 1 out of 10 in the Synoptic Gospels. Synoptic are Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
John, I think the important thing there too is when we first saw these, it said which of these are dealt with most in the Synoptic Gospels? Heaven and hell, sin and grace, economic issues, something else. I mean, it's just economic issues. Yeah, I mean, 1 out of 10, I thought that was.
Luke's Gospel, 1 out of 7. Of the 3 Gospels, Luke does more than the other 2. And the Epistle of James, 1 out of 5, which is the greatest.
Straw epistle.
Yeah. Right, strawy epistle.
I've read about that.
So when you've had a discussion on a topic like this and someone says, well, I think what the church ought to be doing is dealing with the Bible, that's really a kind of strange...
That's an amen.
Oh.
I agree.
Oh, okay.
Then you whip out those and you're benign.
Okay, other things on today's...
One little short thing. I heard somewhere, and it's probably in here, but it just struck me again last night when I was reading this, it's so hard to get your mindset changed in thinking about it as our problem rather than their problem. You keep thinking that the poor Latin Americans, they have a problem, they're poor, and what can we do or what can we all do to help out this problem? And you keep forgetting that that's sort of backwards, that they could be saying, those poor Americans, if they're really Christian, they would be saying, those poor Americans, they really have a problem, what can we do to help them through their problem? And the problem is ours. The problem is the rich man's problem, not the poor man's problem.
It even comes up in our language on the first paragraph, full paragraph on page 35. Just really hit me it was very helpful to talk about overt and covert, and then he talks about that even that distinction is an elitist term implying a violence hidden only to those fortunate enough to be on the uppermost rungs. In other words, those folks in Latin America, that violence ain't covert to them. I mean, it is, it is blatant, and we have to be educated and helped with these semantics you know, to see it, and they live with it every morning, noon, night, and the seductive nature of this whole thing.
You had an interesting experiment with this in the Lutheran Church, and we basically couldn't take it. There was a thing called Mission on Six Continents, whereby the Lutheran World Federation and then the Lutheran Council USA was in essence bringing missionaries to us. It was an acknowledgement of what we need is someone to help us see the part of the world's oppression, oppressor thing as our prison. So they brought people from six different nations, Mission on Six Continents, and they toured the United States for some months. And they expected them to be helpful as to the needs of their country and what have you. And they did what they were asked to do, and that was to point up the predicament of the life of church in the U.S. And we just couldn't, I mean, the thing was squashed. It was not, there was one film made, and the American Lutheran Church, as one discovery probe, Joe Barnt was here. The American Lutheran Church, Jim Sefkus in the ALC, sent money to the Lutheran Council USA and said, here's the American Lutheran Church's money to follow up on Mission on Six Continents, and they would not take the money to do it. So he had a discovery probe and asked Joe Barnt to do it, and kind of unofficially has kept alive the message of Mission on Six Continents. But the ALC, Missouri Synod, and LCA did not really want to advertise what the missionaries told us, because it's hard. It really is. Now, that's a kind of a shorthand. I mean, it's a more complicated story than that. But the reason that there was not a lot of follow-up was the touchiness of how, and that really is hard to do.
That's what Dave Babcock said the same this morning. Or Dave Babcock seen you with him this morning.
Yeah.
I had trouble with what he was saying because it was coming to me as you got to be good before you can pray.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
I had a little trouble with that.
But on the other hand, part of what he was saying was take out the stick in your own eye before you have a log in your own eye before you start operating on your neighbor's stick and or sliver, whatever it is. And I think that was really relevant discussion.
You probably know that what Mary and I tried to do for 2 years is what John said is hard to do. That was to have Lutheran, like your neighbors, like good hardworking farmers, begin to understand some of this. The talks that we've given and the retreats that we've given have been trying to do that without turning them off, without angering them. And I sure am glad when there's any other way in which we can do that. One of the ways that I found that people at least heard it was to quote a speech from the floor of the United Nations. This was a small African country, I think Tanzania, and it was when Russia and the United States were experiencing detente, when they were getting more cordial. Do you remember when that was in the newspaper? All right. On a day where the whole United Nations seemed to have a glow because the two big powers were not fighting so much but were beginning to be more cordial, this African delegate stood up and he had a two-part speech. You can memorize it if you wish because it's very brief. When two elephants fight, the grass suffers. That's the first half of the speech. Second half of the speech is, when two elephants make love, the grass still suffers. And he sat out. That's a profound speech. That's what we have not heard, basically. The two big powers, as far as these little nations are concerned, and Brown has a helpful thing, it would be more accurate to call them the two-thirds nations. Not the third world, but the two-thirds world. Namely, two-thirds of all the people who live are saying, whether you two are fussing with one another or making love, you're still stepping on us. And we really have not had a sense globally. Joe Barnt says it. That's why he gets in trouble. Joe Barnt says it this way. The primary thrust for global justice in the world today is not accidentally or incidentally, but primarily stopping us. Now, if that's the thrust for global justice, if you talk worldwide and all of the liberation movements, or where is the pulse beat for justice today. The thrust of that is not accidentally or incidentally, but primarily in stopping us. And by the us, it's both the communist bloc of nations and the capitalist. I mean, that's not an anti-U.S., it's an anti-big power that essentially has colonized and has used the little nations for their raw materials and everything else. And that's hard to proclaim that and to not, it's hard to proclaim that, and it's hard to find God's good news in that. If you're one of the ones that's going to be stopped, if you ask for a God of history and a God of justice to act, biblically, he lines up with the poor and the oppressed. That's what liberation, that's what James Cone in Black Theology was trying to say. All of those become kind of one-sided, but they're new ways of saying God takes the Israelites and he's going to march them out of Egypt. All right, that's why this book is trying to do something that's really kind of tough to do. And in a brief book, you can make either statements that are not thoroughly backed up, or you can have one that's controversial and move on as though it were settled. Obviously, that you can argue with the book, and people do.
I've seen people really get turned around in the congregation. You talk about Sonia's comment about educating the church. The place not to do it is from the pulpit. Mm-hmm. Becky and I would not do the kind of vespers we did here back home, because that would anger people. It would polarize, I think, at least in a lot of churches I know of. But to take a small group of people who are open to at least talking about it and sit down and read a book together, whether they agree or not, at least they're into some of the issues, I think, and with a thorough bibliography in the back here and all kinds of other resources available that aren't as hard to get at as some of these, I think it's kind of exciting times in the church. I really go back to our conversation that a few of us had last night about parish life, and I'm very hopeful, because I think we aren't, as long as we aren't trying to get back into the 50s, which were the glory days, quote unquote, of the church numerically, if we're concerned about faithfulness, I think there are people who are wanting to be faithful to the gospel and are willing to hear some hard words.
Sean, wouldn't you say that's what Jim was saying yesterday about in the Gospel of Mark study, that a church does not have authority unless they speak to the issues?
Yeah.
Maybe I just heard what I wanted to hear, but I thought that's what he was saying about.
And part of the way is, part of the answer is how that's done. I mean, it's so refreshing when somebody really does that effectively. A Catholic priest stood up one morning in the midst of all of that turmoil and said, stood up in the pulpit, the topic is conscientious objection. He named everything that could blow a parish apart. Everybody was, and at the end of the topic is, he said, 1 month from today in a forum. And then he preached a sermon on the text for the day. And when the forum finally came, it was just great. He gave a month's notice. He disarmed them by letting them think that was going to be the sermon. And they all were buzzing before it came. I mean, it was just a stroke of a better way to handle it than to clobber them from the pulpit. He gave a month's notice. He disarmed them by letting them think that was going to be the sermon, and they all were buzzing before it came. I mean, it was just a stroke of a better way to handle it than to clobber them from the pulpit that day. Or Roy Bloomhorst, Mary and I put that in our book as an illustration. Roy Bloomhorst in Washington, D.C., when Missouri Synod students came for, I guess it was the Cambodian invasion that brought a different kind of student to D.C. It was not the old religious, or not the old political activists. These were kids who had never marched before. It was kind of the final straw. It was the Lutheran kids this time. I mean, they were there. They were there. And so they asked to sleep in the parish hall of this Missouri Synod downtown congregation. Roy said, yeah. So when the congregation came, the anti-war protesters were sleeping in the halls of the church, and it was really just... And his sermon was why the students were there, what the issue was, and I don't know, you know, you couldn't have preached on anything else that day, because that's what everybody was thinking about. Some guy walked by and said, I'm so mad, I can't even talk. And Roy's response was, could you by Wednesday night? And he said, what do you mean? He said, would you be cooled down enough if I come by Wednesday night? And he did, and they talked for 2 hours. I think if you're going to be a pastor, both of those were pastoral acts, saying yes to the students, and when you have to decide, decide on the side of those who said we're here in Christ's name to protest an injustice, and also spend some time pastorally with those who were offended by that. And it's hard to kind of keep that balance. People tend to... want to be a prophet and not really suffer the way a prophet suffers, so have a parish to serve also with a pension plan. And then when you are a parish pastor, resent that you're given basically a hoe, not a scythe, as your tool. You really are. And so we get that role all mixed up. And Dan Berrigan said there are no prophets with a wife and 4 children. I don't know if he knew me when he said that, but we do have 4 children. It did hit me when he said that. Sonia.
No,
oh.
I'm not.
One little digression.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby went to that. And she had a group of students going through Wisconsin, and the person that was driving was a Swiss student, and he didn't have his visa or his passport, and he was speeding. And the police stopped him. Didn't understand this Swiss student, and there's all these strange people in the car, and then there was this funny woman. And I know that a lot of Wisconsin police stop cars and put people in jail for the weekend so they didn't get there. Bobby explained what they were doing and where they were going. So he stopped and was this father and said, you've got to be careful, you've got to get there in one piece. Slow down. And he forgot about the Swiss student without his driver's license or passport.
Hmm.
Get moving. So.
You know, one of the thoughts I have about the whole education thing, you know, this thought started last night when, you know, Debbie was describing a course that she had taken that had to do with global consciousness, and the instructors saying that, you know, we always start first with teaching children about home and then city, state, nation, and then if there's any time left over, we get to global. And, you know, why not start the other way around? And I was really thinking about that, and I know some of the questions we've had from our kids are very difficult to relate to when they go beyond what's pretty definable around them, you know, which means the process has been home, city, state, you know, nation, to try and help them understand. And maybe I just don't know the points of reference to, you know, be able to move out and then back in. But I think that also, for me, has some application to education process, because I think it's kind of difficult to establish global consciousness or help people establish global consciousness when they don't have any local consciousness first. And you know, one of the things I was thinking about was Lutheran Social Services in Columbus has operated a food pantry for years. In fact, when I came there to work, for a lot of years prior to that was about all they did. And it was a joke. You know, they'd have a few food referrals and they'd open up this food pantry a couple afternoons a week, and one of the secretaries would go down and put the food up and pass it out. And I came into that with some very strong feelings about food pantries, after having been in Denver, where the poor decided that there should be no more food pantries because that was relieving the pressure to increase ABC grants, which really kept them in worse poverty.
and made a decision to no longer take food from food pantries and then put the pressure in the other direction. And so I had very negative feelings about this food pantry, but it grew. And the thing that happened to it was, as it grew, they needed more help in it. So they went to the churches and asked people to volunteer in the food pantry. And that turned out to be a truly remarkable program because it has raised local consciousness in a way that you can't ever do just sitting inside of your church and talking about it. And all of these, you know, it tends to be staffed with people who are, you know, unemployed. They're not employed outside of the home. Women, you know, who come home for the first time in their lives. They're finding out what the poor are all about. And then I think they can move on. You know, that really helps move people then to the next step, which is global consciousness.
I really like what you said. I was going to say something a little bit like that, but before you said what you said, I like what you said better than I was going to say. Just trying to remember that global thing isn't the only thing, that it's not that crowded, and that when you talk about it's not just a matter of poor people in the U.S. either. Maybe I was listening between the lines or something, but like when Carter was running, it seemed to me there was a lot of sentiment that he was picking up on that was saying, we, even in this country, are being exploited. There are large institutions up there called government, called big business, called big labor, called big whatever, that run, that make the decisions and run the way things go. And we too need a liberation. I wanted to go another analogy. That's one. The other one is women's lib. Some of the women point out that it's not women's lib anyway, it's men's lib.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, it's a case of men and women getting together and saying, what can we do about these poor women that are not able to work like we are? And the women are saying, or some women are saying, that's maybe not the point where the emphasis should be. Maybe it should be on how badly screwed up is our society that the men are doing all this work. When they just be at home, take care of their kids. So much.
Let me ask a particular question as far as an area. Are there questions about either the way he moves in these two chapters, the premise? Is there a clarity question at all about the content of these two chapters? Was it understandable? Did you? Did you think his 4 points about we are in a revolutionary situation, did you basically think those are sound, or did you have arguments with them? Or? Doesn't seem as though you were.
Well, the thought I had was that if this book is going to hang around much longer, he really needs to update it because if he's going to base the fact that we're in the middle of a revolution on what was happening a number of years ago, I think the revolution is still there, but I think it's in some ways less obvious in this country now than it was a number of years ago. And so he needs to have some updating in terms of examples.
Yeah. Okay.
I think that's what's even tougher right now, is that the revolution is less obvious now. Years ago, there's less stirring.
The Indian issues are under the table someplace. I can't find them. Black issues are under the table.
Mm-hmm.
The migrant worker problems are still there, but there's problems.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still bad.
Yep.
Because is the next in the sequence, and to me is still a route back to the core. For a lot of people, it's a route back to the core problem. There's a lot of ways into it.
his premise is there is a revolution. Rapid social change is a euphemism. It is a revolution. There is no doubt that the revolution will continue. The question is the form it will take, violence or nonviolence. In past history, the powerful do not give away power. The powerless, finally, it gets to the point where they revolt in some way and take some. Past history would say that the powerful will not vote to share the wealth. There are still ways in which that could take place. The United Nations new international economic order, if the powerful voted to have a kind of redistribution and a more equitable distribution of funds, those are people who still hope for that rather than a revolution, especially a bloody revolution. I don't know if there's any things that I feel are necessary for the... Obviously, he wants to show the pervasiveness of violence, even with the Solzhenitsyn quote at the top of page 29. Violence, less and less embarrassed by the limits imposed by centuries of lawfulness, is brazenly and victoriously striding across the whole world. I'll give you one personal aside. Darrell Bryant wrote A World Broken by Unshared Bread, World Council of Churches. He's quoted on page 31. That was one of the really good experiences that we had in D.C. The Lutheran Planning Council of Washington, D.C. brought Darrell down to D.C. in the midst of the Poor People's Campaign. He was a graduate student in theology, and he accepted invitations into Lutheran parishes for a month, every day, morning, noon, evening, whenever he was invited, to reflect theologically on what the Poor People's Campaign was. And it really was well received. We very rarely do that. In the midst of the social thing, invite the church to do what we say the church is all about, and that's to see theologically what's happening. So he put it in biblical perspective, and it was really, and it was well received. It was very helpful.
How can you support programs like that? How could I... Debbie and I had some money to give to the church last year. We got this little pamphlet, which was helpful about designated giving. But we wanted to be able to say, okay, here's, give it into something like this.
Yeah.
And we didn't know how to do it.
Well, that was, I mean, we just did it in D.C. So, I mean, it was a D.C., it was not a national, it was a local Lutheran Planning Council who felt that one of our contributions could be to try to theologically reflect on that which is happening in our midst. So, I don't know if there's another way to find designated funds or not.
Well, our church in D.C. kept giving designated funds for the ALC, and they kept rejecting.
Okay. We would send a check made out to a thing we wanted the ALC to support, and we wanted them to accept the check and then be sure they would forward it on.
you could send a check and designate it for the type of program you wanted to support, but that just means that somebody else's money is going to get used to fill in the gap on the other stuff.
Yeah,
right.
I don't think they would even.
Would
they even find that type of thing that I'm talking about?
They might.
I'm just so disillusioned with my church structure that I really have. Once in a while, these little things happen, but I just don't see that it's institutionally available, or you don't hear about it, or you don't.
A couple of years ago, if you'd sent in a check saying you wanted to go to a program on peace and nonviolence, it would have helped pay John's salary.
Okay. Probably the person that got the check wouldn't even heard of John or what John's program was.
I was with the National Church for those 4 years. Yes, they would have known that.
Okay.
Yeah, there still are discovery probes like this Joe Barnt who does internationalization of mission. That's still ALC national funds to do that. I made a note that the bookstore did have. Does it still have Bonino's book, Doing Theology in a Revolutionary Situation?
Yes.
All right. If you want just one readable, understandable theology of liberation, some of it is really heavy reading. Bonino's book is fairly good as a as a one shot at trying to understand what especially Latin American theologians are doing. Much of their theology is very much like these two chapters, or comes from the setting of that conference in 68 of those priests and that. And the bookstore, we chose one that we thought was fairly good if someone had not done a lot of reading and did not have a lot of theology. Obviously, in this chapter, he gets back to the difference between acts of violence and a state of violence. In other words, you begin to see the reasons that he spent some time defining terms, right? It's not only the violence in the slums, it's the violence of the slums. He really tries to illustrate a point, and I think that's helpful. I guess the one that's... it's understandable. It's the kind that John says is part of our trouble, telling that to neighbors in the rural areas and what have you. Structures that benefit us often work against others. That's the dilemma that I think is the toughest part of if we try to get to then, what do we do? When we get to Friday, that one, you just have to kind of live with it, or at least try to see that it's part of the problem. I was glad that he took two case studies, Camilo Torres and Dom Elder Camara, who agree on the analysis of the problem, who are both Roman Catholics, who have an agreement of faith, who agree on structured violence, and who disagree on the means. And part of what I hope that the study together will do is to give you, if you remember that just war, pacifism, and crusade debate, one of the last things I said yesterday was there is no unambiguous place to stand. They both have scriptural background to it. It really is a tough one to sort through as to where do I stand in faithfulness on those issues, and here are two examples of people who disagree on the means. And I don't know if your conclusion is that it doesn't make that much difference of whether or not you disagree on the means. If you're working toward the same goal, that's about where it is in the world today, that's not so all important as long as you're working for justice. In fact, some of the proponents for nonviolence admit that. Gandhi says it is better to be violent and to work for justice than it is to use nonviolence as a cloak to cover your impotence and you're not doing anything. In other words, first of all, if there is an injustice, work to end that injustice. That's what Christ calls you to do. Now, Gandhi says, and Christ's way is through nonviolence. That's really the most radical. The other is accepting the world's way of doing it, and Christ calls us to a better way. All right. But if you can't go that better way, it's better still to work for justice, even if you have to be violent, than not entering into it at all. Non-involvement is a non-option. All right. That's the kind of thing that I think we will not come to consensus on or even try by Friday, but that's one of the things that's still in that mix. By the way, Dom Elder Camara is really... an inspiring man. If you've not read it, if this introduces you to a new friend, he really is. Do you have The Desert is Fertile? Mm-hmm. $1.25, little paperback. It's a devotional book. Really is. I mean, if you can take the issues like we're in today and have somebody make them just inspiring, not gloomy, not a put down. He's just delightful. It's 5'5". He never accepted his jeweled cross as a bishop. He wears a wooden one. He lives in the barrio instead of in a palace. I guess I just recommend Desert is Fertile, and will. But when you see him quoted, I really think he's an amazing man.
Just from a strictly pragmatic or realistic viewpoint, the difference between the two, you might say, is Camara is still alive, therefore has a word to say. Torres is 6 foot under. Not to say that, you know, I'm not critiquing him, but that's just one, that was my first thought. I mean, and that's so typically true, too, that, you know, you get very violent, very angry, and let it all blow, and then you're kind of like you shot your wad.
Yeah.
And I think there's the nonviolent approach as a much There's much more gospel in that, it seems to me.
You know, that raises an interesting question as to whether your life is of higher value than anything else, which I had never, you know, really thought about before. We tend to think that human life ought to be preserved at all costs, although, I mean, obviously that's called into question at points, like people being kept alive on respirators and stuff, but I think it would be hard to decide whether somebody's death might make more difference in it than another person's life. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's hard to take is in the Old Testament, when the Lord God commanded the Israelites to kill all these nations off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are some of the passages for the crusade spirit. I mean, that those were holy wars, that you were fighting for God. Those are tough ones. Whether that's what they chose to hear, you know, whether they use that as their substantiation, that's tough. I'm going to close with one comment that I think is. I think these two chapters help us understand the comment. That's the way I want to say it. Manas Buthelezi is another hero right now of mine. I've heard him. I've met him. He lived in D.C. for 6 months. He's back. He's Zululand is his homeland. Yes, South Africa. Was in the Christian Institute, and now he's elected to be the head of that church. He's in a position for the black church in South Africa, and a real fine fellow. One of the arguments against restrictions on South Africa by the United States is, but then the blacks will suffer even more. In other words, if you take away the present power structure and even jobs, won't the Soweto blacks, at least temporarily, have worse suffering for a while than though we continue to support a system based on apartheid, but still the financial base for the country. Isn't that better than chaos? And Buthelezi's answer to us, and I guess Bishop Owala in essence says the same thing. We will suffer if you do that. But we are suffering now, and if we suffer that other way, we will be suffering in hope. Now we suffer without hope. And I'm not sure, unless you live there, that you understand that maybe that structural violence is really worse suffering than the collapse and the revolution and even the physical violence, because to suffer without hope is a dimension that is hard to put some kind of quantity on. So that's the answer of those who want the United States to just let happen what has to happen and stop supporting that government there. And I think these two chapters help me a little bit understand how Buthelezi might be able to say that. I hope that wasn't so heavy that you can't enjoy your coffee break or do something foolish.